and welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, and I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we have a great show for you this hour. We're obviously going to be catching up on some of the news. I'm going to walk you through the most disastrous breaches of 2019, and our deep dive is looking forward to 2020. So what are the five major trends in technology that will continue to explode in 2020, and what are five predictions of what's going to happen in 2020 as it relates to technology and cybersecurity? So stick around. It's going to be great. Feel free to disagree with my predictions, although I think I'm right, obviously. And with that, let's start with the news. And in victim news, according to a survey which was commissioned by MoneyGram, the most common digital security threat facing Americans today is some type of scam, with 63% of respondents saying they've experienced this. Now, if we are looking at this, basically 9 out of 10 Americans in some way, shape, or form have been the victim of fraud now, per statistics, and this actually gets worse. 56% of people say they've been a victim of a fraud, and 54% of people say they've had their social media account hacked. Nearly half of the respondents, 49%, have been the victim of a data breach. And so when you were looking at this, some of these overlap, but a lot of these are unique, which adds up a lot more to the general population. Now, these numbers may seem high, but consider this. Many respondents admitted they engage in risky online behaviors. So, for example, 10% said they would actually answer a phone call from an unknown number or an email from unknown origin. 1 in 8 said they would respond to romantic requests online from somebody they never met. 1 in 9 even said they would respond to a job offer from a firm they've never applied to, especially if the email had a nearly but not quite identical name to a famous global company. Participants were also quizzed on common digital security red flags. In all, 48% recognized the common scam of being asked to wire money to a stranger, meaning 52% had no idea. Another 47% are correctly wary of whenever someone asks them for money with the promise of an even larger sum in return. We see that all the time. Send me $500, you'll get $1 million, whatever. 53% of us basically are not aware of that scam. And finally, 44% said they are never fooled by a phone call from a fake government agency asking for money to avoid jail time. That's a common scam. The fake IRS call saying you owe taxes, etc. And here we are. And that means 56% of us are not aware that these scams are around. Now, when asked about their biggest online security worries, respondents listed having their personal information exposed in a data breach as their most frequent concern. That was 53%, followed by having money stolen from their online bank accounts or online money management tool. That's 52%, or having their social security number stolen as well, also 52%, and rounding out the top five, whereas basically people afraid of malware designed to infiltrate online banks and just fraud in general. But here's the thing. So while the vast majority of us are worried about this, have been hit, or are simply clueless, only 50% of us would actually consider getting off the grid, quote unquote, to make sure that their data is safe. So what does this tell us? When we are looking at this, what does this tell us? We are willing to take risks online, even if we're aware that we're not properly defending ourselves or can even spot all of the ways that we can be hit. With only 50% of the population willing to go off the grid to protect data, I kind of think this shows that basically we have a level of addiction to technology that makes us accept risk basically for the endorphin hit of getting likes and followers and all of that. We are not going to abandon our technology, even if there's a high probability of us getting hit in technology, because we have not taken the time, or money to educate ourselves, to be aware of these things, to buy proper defenses, all this kind of stuff. Now, you can minimize your risk online. Obviously, don't sign up for anything. That would be the first thing. Get off of social media, or just severely limit what you put on social media, because it's being data mined to the nth degree. And if you are a regular listener of mine, I do not have to dive into all of that, as I have consistently done in the last couple of years on this radio show. Enable multi-factor authentication. But sadly, other surveys outside of this basically say that this may be moot. So Pew did research where 89% could not even identify what multi-factor authentication is when given a panel of four different screenshots and was asked basically to identify which one was MFA, multi-factor authentication. So we have a serious problem with education on our hands. And so that basically is your fraud slash scam news of the week. But if you're sitting here in America, basically, 9 out of 10 of us have experienced this in some way, shape, or form, minor or major, and that is a serious issue. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And in Ring doorbell news, and if you have a Ring doorbell, heads up, listen to this. The police can keep your Ring doorbell footage forever and share it with anyone they wish. Now, here's what's going on. Ring, which basically makes surveillance equipment and cameras, as I'm pretty sure most of you know, has quote-unquote partnerships with more than 600 law enforcement agencies nationwide, allowing those police to access users' footage. And while Ring says that it's set terms around how and when it will share that footage with police, anything the police do with it afterwards is entirely out of Ring's hands, and that is according to Ring themselves. So, Senator Ed Markey, he's a Democrat from Massachusetts, in September demanded clearer answers from Amazon and Ring and published the company's responses last week. And so I am going to actually read you some of his questions, not the whole thing, but those that I've collected, as well as the responses by Ring. And so Senator Markey asked, and I quote, "Does Ring require police department partners to delete users' footage after a certain amount of time? If not, why not?" Ring responded, and I quote, "Ring does not require law enforcement to delete materials shared through a video request after a certain period of time. Law enforcement departments may be subject to local record keeping laws that require them to retain investigative materials for a defined period of time. Law enforcement may also need to retain the videos for a longer period of time to complete ongoing investigations or while the case is pending." Now, I find that interesting in the sense that, you know, Ring could have the ability per local ordinance or local law or state law to basically house these videos for them and force the police to basically stay in their ecosystem so they can revoke rights at will. Instead, they are letting the police just simply download the video footage and do whatever the police want with it, store it where they want, you know, for whatever. So while compliance law in terms of record keeping is valid, how they're going about it basically takes that data out of their control, which is the antithesis of privacy control for their customers. Now, Senator Markey also asked, "Does Ring require police department partners to institute security safeguards to ensure that the Ring footage to which they have access is not breached or otherwise accessed by unauthorized entities? If so, please describe these security measurements. If not, why not?" And so Ring responded, "Each law enforcement agency has its own requirements, protocols, and security measures for material stored in its files. Ring does not impose requirements beyond law enforcement's own procedures." So that is a cop-out. And the reason why that's a cop-out is that we have basically in cybersecurity supply chain verification. So if I am, let's say, a larger company and I am working with a smaller one, before I'm working with them, I can send them a questionnaire and basically say, tell me about your security practices, put it in writing that you are assuring that I'm going to basically adhere to these policies. And oftentimes it doesn't happen. I have worked with various law enforcement, you know, departments in terms of cybersecurity, data security assessments and all of that. And they range from, you know, excellent top notch to, oh my God, why aren't hackers walking into this police department right now? You know, or maybe they are, we just don't know, you know? And so you can't really leave it up to the person in the same way that IoT development shouldn't be left up to the individual to secure it. It should be done at the development level from the manufacturer. So Senator Markey also asks, Does Ring prohibit police departments with access from users' footage from sharing that footage with other entities? If not, why not? Is Ring aware of any instances in which police departments have shared users' footage with third parties? If so, please describe in detail all such instances. Now, Ring says, and I quote, Ring only permits the requesting law enforcement officer and agency administrator the ability to view video footage that Ring users explicitly agreed to share. If videos are downloaded by law enforcement, Ring does not require police departments to agree to additional restrictions, as the videos may become public records subject to certain record keeping and transparency requirements. For example, if the videos are used in an investigation that leads to criminal charges or a trial, the videos can become public record. In addition, it is standard practice for law enforcement agencies to collaborate on investigations. Ring would not receive a notification each time law enforcement agency shared information to solve a crime. Ring is constantly seeking ways to maximize transparency and user control, including adding additional information on how video footage may be used when a customer consents. Now, there's a couple of different things that I want to say about this real quick. Just as I'm going through this. One, Ring, or Amazon in this case, that owns Ring, has completely passed the buck when it comes to security and privacy of its users, but not by not requiring any real standard for data security of this footage that it allows police to take without a warrant. Police can actually get your Ring doorbell footage without a warrant. The next point I want to make is that Amazon has completely geared this up for maximum revenue at the expense of user privacy. We know that whistleblowers talking to The Intercept, about Ring, just as they were being bought by Amazon, basically said that Ring had left the complete backend unencrypted. They had users in foreign countries, or rather employees in foreign countries, that could access this information. And it seems that Amazon is more geared to selling this to police departments to give them access as a money-making venture than it is to actually securing the Ring users' information. The next point I want to make is that Amazon and law enforcement combined have created a massive surveillance network that is letting the government into a system that was designed for paying customers to protect their homes, and this partnership has zero oversight whatsoever. The mere fact that a senator has to inquire directly with a list of questions is a serious issue. Basically, who is watching this? Amazon is selling these Ring doorbells at breakneck speed, and then they're selling the ability to access your Ring doorbell to your local law enforcement at breakneck speed, and there is virtually no oversight on this, and I think that's a very serious issue. And finally, I'd like to say on this that thanks to Ring's past of being hacked, having vulnerabilities, and allowing foreign nationals in other countries to access your footage, not using encryption, prior to the sale of Ring to Amazon, and for the record, nobody has actually shown us that they're now encrypting it under Amazon's control either, that basically most people are clueless as to the severe vulnerabilities this is adding to their homes, privacy, and wireless networks. We also just recently heard a case where, the Blink cameras from Amazon, also part of Ring, were being accessed by hackers that were literally like talking to little kids, like, hey, little girl, I'm Santa, kind of stuff, creepily, and saying horrible and awful things to homeowners. And that is in part, I think, lack of security, but it's also in part users not using good passwords or reusing passwords. But we have a serious problem here with Ring and other surveillance things. We don't know where our data goes. And in this case, we know that law enforcement can access it at will without our consent. They don't need it. And so that's a serious issue. And I think we all need to take that to heart. And so that is your Ring doorbell news and Amazon news of the week. And in federal law enforcement news, the FBI is actually using Facebook to target Russians in Washington, D.C. Now, here's what's going on. The Facebook is running ads on Facebook in the Washington, D.C. area, seemingly designed to target and recruit Russian spies as well as those who know about their work. So this is according to CNN. Now, one ad that was seen by CNN features a stock photo of a young woman at her graduation with her family, and the Russian text overlaid on that image reads, and I quote, "For your future, for the future of your family." Another one shows a picture of a chess set with Russian text that translates to, and I quote, "Isn't it time for you to make your move?" And another one includes a drawing of a man walking over a bridge with a Russian caption that reads, and I quote, "Time to draw bridges." Now, some of the Russian in the ads are awkwardly phrased or contain typos, which is an indication that they may not have been written by a native Russian speaker. Now, the ad directs to a page on the FBI Washington, D.C. Fields Office website that has details in English and Russian about the counterintelligence team and the address of the FBI office in the city to basically say, come and visit us in person. Now, the FBI did not confirm any details about their ad campaign. However, many people saw their ads, or if anyone responded to them, they basically weren't saying, the FBI wasn't saying that. So, however, the ads, which are run from FBI's verified Facebook page, are publicly viewable through a Facebook tool that tracks active advertising campaigns on the platform. So you could pretty much go see them yourself if you want to scroll back in history. Now, Alan E. Kohler Jr., he's a special agent in charge of Washington Field Office Counterintelligence Division, told CNN on Tuesday, and I quote, "We cannot comment except to note that Russia has a large number of intelligence officers based in Russian diplomatic facilities around the world. They are very active and pose a security risk to the U.S. and our allies. The FBI uses a variety of means to gather information, including the use of sources. The FBI will use all legal means available to locate individuals with information that can help protect the United States from threats to our national security. Russia has long been a counterintelligence threat to the U.S., and the FBI will continue to adapt our investigative and outreach techniques to counter that threat." So, here we are gearing up once again for the 2020 presidential election. Basically, the FBI is targeting Russian nationals or those of Russian origin in the United States that could help the FBI, basically identify and further the cause of figuring this stuff out. And if these ads are written in poor Russian, maybe that was intentionally done, as a methodology to get somebody that is Russia to say, oh, like, I love this country. They clearly suck at Russian. Maybe I should go and help them with something like that. So that might just be a clever psychological ploy, by the FBI to do that. So we'll see where that goes. But I found that to be pretty interesting news. And so that is your federal law enforcement news of the week. And now for breaches of the week. And if you have a data breach to report that's local to you or the major news might have missed it, please, by all means, send it to me. And I'm glad to give you a shout out and include it in the radio show and possibly a daily video. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can email questions at securityfanatics.com. Again, that's questions at securityfanatics.com. And I'm more than happy to include your data breach and give you a shout out on the air. With that, let's begin. And this week's Breaches of the Week is actually a roundup. Since this is our last show of the year, I wanted to kind of do a year in review of the data breaches that have just been absolutely bonkers out there since January all the way up to now. And who knows, maybe the day after you listen to this, we're going to have some massive disaster worth of a breach that should have been there. But as of the listening, or you're listening to this, these are the breaches out there from January to December that we're just completely off the rails. And we are actually going to start in January. Let's do this chronologically. So in January, there was a breach known as Collection Number One. Now, this was basically revealed by Troy Hunt. He owns a website called Have I Been Pwned? That is where you can go and check if you've been part of a data breach. And he discovered a data set containing over 770 million unique email addresses and 21 million unique passwords that had been compiled in multiple data breaches and sitting there in the dark web. It was called Collection Number One. That was a massive issue. Moving on, in January as well, basically there was an Elasticsearch cloud storage compromise that over 108 million records of bets made at websites belonging to an online casino group were stored on this Elasticsearch server and had not been secured with a password. And so researchers were able to find this, and they were able to find players' names, email addresses, home addresses, phone numbers, bets, wins, deposits, and withdrawals for 108 million records worth of that, which is a massive, massive data breach. In February, the basically Dream Market, which is an online online marketplace in the dark web to sell malicious stuff, had a data breach themselves, and 620 million account details were stolen from 16 hacked websites and got dumped publicly outside of Dream Market breach. And so basically, if you used any one of these, you were affected. Dubsmash, MyFitnessPal, which was huge, MyHeritage, the DNA place, Share This, Houtlook, Animoto, IEM, 8Fit, White Pages, Photolog, 500px, Armor Games, Bookmate, Coffee Meets Bagel, which I think is a dating website, Artsy, and Data Camp. And so if you used any of those, you were one of the 620 million people that got dumped into the dark web again after the dark web market breach, Dream Market, was hit. And we're still in February. So with that, let's move on to March, because March had a major Facebook breach. Now, Facebook claimed, and I disputed this claim because I did a video on this, that basically they had a bug in their password management system that left hundreds of millions of users with their passwords stored in plain text. Meaning, let's say you had a super awesome and complex password to log into Facebook. They were not actually encrypting that in their system. They were storing that in plain text. So over 80,000 Facebook employees could have read that. And that was a very, very serious issue. It also affected Instagram, which they downplayed. And then a month later, they went and changed the language to increase that number, trying to slide that under the radar. And fortunately, journalists were able to catch that. So Facebook had a massive data breach in March. Also in March, there's a website called Verifications.io. Now, they have a database containing 982 million email addresses, and that was leaked by the marketing company, and it's one of the biggest email database breaches to have ever occurred. Now, this marketing company, the Verifications.io, sent emails to email addresses to verify if they were valid, but it had absolutely no security measures in place to protect this database, and so obviously that got exposed. Moving on to April, we have Facebook again. So we've got March and April for Facebook. Now, Facebook users were basically, they're always at risk of getting their data exposed and all of that, but in this case, we've got a third-party issue. So according to UpGuard, these are the ones that found this. Basically, a digital media company called Cultura Colectiva, which was based in Mexico, had data scraped 540 million records, user IDs, account names, likes, comments, etc., and they had put that onto a server that got publicly exposed. Another smaller data breach, also discovered during this time, was basically for an app that was integrated into Facebook called App the Pool, and that exposed over 22,000 user passwords through a backup to Amazon. Like, basically they're hiring Amazon to store the information, and they were storing those in plain text as well. During that same period, researchers found almost 100,000 Facebook databases sitting in things like Amazon Web Services by third-party developers that were scraping data from Facebook and just basically putting it out there. And so it's not just Facebook that is exposing us. It's their access or their allowance of third parties in the past to scrape all of this data out there. And now hundreds of millions of us have been exposed by virtue of Facebook's poor policies. And so that is April, and that is the second Facebook breach that we have talked about. And now in May, there's a company called Canva. They revealed that a cyber attacker had managed to access over 139 million user informations, including names, email addresses, countries of residence, and cryptographically protected passwords. The attacker was also able to briefly view credit card details before September 2016. And again, this took place in May 2019, but the details were insufficient to make transactions. Canva managed to stop the attack midway through, but it still urged users to change their passwords just to be on the safe side. So if you used Canva back in May, you probably got hit. Keeping in May, we're going to be talking about First American Corp. Now, this is a Fortune 500 financial services company, and basically they revealed that They basically allowed over 885 million records to be publicly accessed by anyone who had ever emailed a link to a document by the company. So merely by changing a single digit in the document link, you could access other users' wire transactions dating all the way back to 2003. Now, these documents contain tax records, bank account numbers, social security numbers, driver's license images, mortgage records, etc., etc. Krebs on Security, that's by Brian Krebs, reported that a developer named Ben Shoval had noticed this breach and notified the company, which shut down the website leaking the data. And so here we are. First American Corp was one of the massive breaches of 2019. Heading up to July 29th, some of you guys might remember the Capital One data breach. Now, this was really one of the big ones of 2019, at least in terms of future ramifications. Now, a Seattle-based software engineer named Paige Thompson was arrested after hacking the database of Capital One, and Capital One is one of the largest banks in the United States, if you are not aware. Now, according to the New York Times, she managed to steal over 80,000 bank account numbers, more than 140,000 social security numbers, and over 1 million Canadian social insurance numbers, and millions of credit card applications. The data stolen dated back as far as 2005, and the bank reported that the breach could potentially cost them more than $300 million in remediation, compliance, you know, et cetera, offering free credit monitoring to millions of people. That was a mess, and that exposed a ton of information. And Ms. Thompson, from what I understand, is currently going through the United States court system. So we'll see where that goes. Moving on, we're going to head to September, and we are talking once again about Facebook. So we've got March, April, and now September. They've made the list at least three times here, and we'll keep on rolling. Now, in September, a security researcher had discovered databases containing more than 419 million records tied to Facebook accounts. It appears the data, which includes phone numbers, Facebook IDs, and in some cases, users' names, genders, and countries, was scraped from the platform. However, it's not clear who got that information from Facebook or why. Now, the data set included 133 million records on Facebook users in the United States, 18 million on people in the United Kingdom, and 50 million users in Vietnam. Now, the researcher that found this, Sanyam Jain, found the databases on an exposed server that wasn't protected with a password. And so he told TechCrunch he found phone numbers linked to several different celebrities as well. And so basically Facebook responded to this one and said, and I quote, "The data set is old and appears to have information obtained before we made changes last year to remove people's abilities to find others using their phone number." And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.